Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to our half-hour English feature program. I'm Susie Hodges. Coming up on today's program, Papal Audience. Pope Benedict looks at the figure of St. Alphonsus de Liguori and his teaching on the beauty of daily prayer in his first general audience since his July vacation. Praying for prisoners. The welfare of prisoners is the focus of the Pope's prayer intentions for August. But what's the situation really like for those held behind bars in the UK? Pass it on. We find out more about the Catholic aid agency CAFOD's Olympic Peace Campaign and how it is urging young people to pass on the peace. And Caritas on AIDS HIV, no room for complacency. We get an update from a Caritas expert on AIDS about the outcome of the recent International AIDS Conference in Washington. At his first Wednesday audience since his vacation in July, Pope Benedict focuses on the figure of St. Alphonsus de Liguori and his teaching on the beauty of daily prayer. Emma McCarthy tells us more.
In nomine Patris et Filii et Spiritus Sancti. Pax vobis.
Pope Benedict XVI resumed his weekly appointment with pilgrims this Wednesday, who packed into Castel Gandolfo's tiny Freedom Square in front of the papal summer residence to hear the Holy Father's latest instalment in his School of Christian Prayer series.
I greet all the English-speaking pilgrims.
With one eye on the liturgical calendar, Pope Benedict dedicated his reflections to one of the most popular 18th-century saints, Alphonsus de Liguori, Doctor of the Church and founder of the Redemptorist Order, who, said the Pope, teaches us to pray to God for the grace to live wisely and well.
A great moral theologian, the master of prayer, St. Alphonsus teaches us the beauty of daily prayer, in which we open our minds and hearts to the Lord's presence.
In comments in Italian, Pope Benedict spoke of St. Alphonsus's treatise, Prayer, the Great Means of Salvation and of Perfection. The Pope said it teaches us not to be afraid to seek help from the Lord, who never denies it to those who pray to him with humility, remembering that he who prays is saved, he who does not pray is damned. St. Alphonsus, concluded the Pope, reminds us that our relationship with God is essential in our lives, because it directs, illuminates, and makes safe and peaceful our path, even in the midst of difficulties and dangers.
By his example and intercession, may you and your families come to know God's saving love and experience his abundant blessings.
Finally, the Holy Father greeted all those present at the audience and bestowed upon them his apostolic blessing.
Amen.
I'm Emer McCarthy.
Benedict's general prayer intention for the month of August is that prisoners may be treated with justice and respect for their human dignity. But prisoners often have little voice and their plight is rarely in the public eye. So how often and in what ways are inmates' rights and dignity violated during their incarceration? In the UK, for instance, the prison population has more than doubled over the past two decades, and figures show that the nation incarcerates more of its population than any other country in Western Europe. So what is the current situation really like for prisoners held behind bars in Britain? To gain an inside view, I spoke to Monsignor Malachy Keegan in England. He's the Catholic Bishop's prison advisor and has worked as a prison chaplain for over 15 years. I began by asking him for his reaction to the news that the Pope is dedicating this month's prayer intention to the welfare of prisoners.
Well, I'm delighted, really. And I know that the Holy Father has a special love for people held in prisons. In fact, if I remember, just before Christmas last year, he visited a Rebibbia prison in Rome and spoke to the prisoners there, saying to them that he carried them in his heart.
And given that his prayer intention is that prisoners may be treated with justice and respect for their human dignity, and presumably, sadly, that, of course, is not always the case. Their rights are sometimes violated, and, of course, they're locked up out of sight and often without a voice.
I think that's perfectly true sometimes. If people commit crimes, then they are punished, and the deprivation of their liberty is a real form of punishment. But sometimes the conditions in which prisoners are held in prisons, overcrowding, little opportunity to look at the issues behind the crimes, sometimes that's a sort of double type of punishment, really. I think if the state feels it has to lock up its citizens, then the state itself has to ensure that the time spent in prison is spent wisely, that people in prison have an opportunity to look at the reasons behind the crime, given opportunities to change.
And are most prisoners in England or Wales nowadays still locked up in their cells for most of the day, or are there more and more cases where they can do a craft or work or study?
I think many of our prisoners, most of them, find it very difficult to make the experience of prison meaningful. There are so many people held in our prisons that there often are little opportunities for people to, as I say, address the issues behind the crime, perhaps, you know, learn skills that will make them employable in the future. There's so many people in the system that for the majority of prisoners, there's little or no opportunity to make the time spent in prison meaningful or useful for them. It becomes, in fact, pretty much pure punishment.
And talking of punishment, I read that England and Wales incarcerate a higher proportion of their population than most other countries in Western Europe. Why is that?
Well, I think that's true, and I think it's because we're very punitive in the way we respond to offending behaviour, not very creative at all. I mean, I think there are alternatives to custodial sentences. For example, community payback schemes. They're schemes that enable prisoners to repay in some way the individuals and communities they've damaged. Prisoners do work in the community, perhaps creating a local park or repainting somebody's house, that kind of thing, as a gesture of goodwill and repayment for the harm that they've done.
And when it comes to the prisoners themselves, I mean, how many of them have mental health problems or maybe struggle with drug addictions? Here too, surely a custodial sentence can't be the right way of treating those problems.
Well, we have huge numbers of people in our prisons with mental health issues. In fact, it's over 80%. Most of the people held in our prisons come from very chaotic backgrounds, very difficult early life, often suffered abuse, have very poor educational backgrounds and so on. And the conditions in which people are held in prison doesn't really help. I mean, a standard prison cell would be something like 10 foot by 8 foot. And that space would be shared with another prisoner who may be volatile, coming off drugs or something like that. If somebody went into prison without a mental health issue, that kind of experience could lead to mental health problems.
And what proportion of prisoners in jails in the UK reoffend? Because this is another issue, isn't it? You know, how able is the system to rehabilitate these people and stop them reoffending?
Well, very large numbers sadly reoffend, especially among the young offenders. My conviction as a psychotherapist and a priest is that we need people around us to support us if we are going to change some aspect of our lives. And one of the pieces of work that we do as prison chaplains is to try to engage our outside faith communities, our parishes. So when people leave prison, we have schemes. We offer support to former offenders. We have one very wonderful scheme that we've been working on in recent years called Basic Caring Communities. And fundamentally, we go into a parish, we ask for volunteers, and we train volunteers to work with offenders when they leave prison, a sort of circle of support. And they offer daily contact with that person for the next 4 or 5 months. And the contact can be as little as a phone call, how are you doing today, I hope you're well. Or it can be an offer to meet on the high street for a cup of coffee and a chat, or an offer to go with the former offender down to the job centre to look for employment. But then once a week, the whole little group come together in a neutral place, the 4 or 5 volunteers and the former offender, and they sit down together and have a cup of tea together and chat and enjoy each other's company. And my experience working in the prisons now for over 15 years tells me that for most of the people in prison, that could well be the first time in their lives that they've had a real experience of being valued, of being heard, of belonging, of being connected. And that, coupled with some practical help with jobs and training and housing, can actually change lives. And so we are inviting our faith communities to help us in the resettlement of offenders.
What percentage of prisoners are Catholic? And of those, how important is their faith to them when they're behind bars?
Well, out of the 88,000 people held in our prisons today, I think about 16,000 would be Catholics. And for many people, coming into prison is such a traumatic experience. And often the only thing that remains to them is their faith. And their faith becomes terribly important to them. And often people's hearts open to the Word of God like never before in their lives.
Can you then share with us a brief anecdote of an inmate that is particularly inspirational for you, where, as you say, his faith really helped to transform his life?
Yes, well, when I joined the prison service as a chaplain almost 16 years ago now, one of the first people I met in prison had just arrived in the prison after committing a very serious offence. In fact, it was murder. And this man was in deep trauma about coming into prison, in deep trauma about the terrible crime he'd committed. He was drunk at the time, I think. And I kind of got to know him quite well when I was chaplain in that particular prison. And over the last 15 years, while he remained in prison, I've kept in touch with him and visited him sometimes as he's moved round from prison to prison. But during these 15 years, something quite remarkable has happened to him, I think. About 10 or 12 years ago, he asked me if I had a copy of the Divine Office, which I gave him, and he has prayed the Divine Office every single day for the last 12 years in his prison cell. He comes to Mass and receives Holy Communion as often as he possibly can. He reads the scriptures every single day. He studied, actually taken and has a theology degree now. And any day soon, he'll be released from prison. And he tells me that what he wishes to do with the rest of his life is to help people to discover God and God's love. He wants to spend the rest of his life caring for other people, helping people in danger to avoid crime, to avoid going into prison. And that's a wonderful conversion experience, I think, that occurred during these years in prison.
Are there many such cases, or are these anecdotes rather far and few between?
Well, I think quite dramatic conversions like that are probably fairly rare. But I think many, many people in prison are touched by the Spirit of God at work in the prison context. In spite of prisons being a brutal, I think often inhuman experience, wonderful things happen because people have time to think, they have time to listen to the Word of God. We make sure that there is Mass in every prison once a week. And we have 180 chaplains who help people to discover their faith in a new way, perhaps for the first time.
I was speaking to Monsignor Malachy Keegan, Catholic prison chaplain. Past Peace on the Peace is the slogan of the London-based Catholic aid agency CAFOD's Olympic Peace Campaign. The initiative is inspired by the 100 days truce that accompanied the ancient Olympics in Greece, set up so that athletes could travel to the Games in safety. CAFOD has been encouraging its young supporters, especially from schools, to take part in this campaign that involves uploading video clips and posting personal messages to all those in the world who are not living in peace in 2012. Susan Kambula is a coordinator of CAFOD's Olympic Peace Campaign for Schools, and she told me more about the project.
Well, Pass It On is a fun online solidarity action where young people make a film of themselves moving from left to right across the camera, so they then can upload that film to our CAFOD website and then take part in an online relay, so they see themselves moving across the screen. But the main thing is, once you've uploaded the video, you then send your message for peace, which can be shared with people throughout the world who are not living in peace and people who are working for peace.
What are you hoping it will achieve, and for how long will it run?
It's based on the idea of the Olympic truce, and particularly we've had a focus in Britain this year on the 100 days of peace. So the idea that from 50 days before the start of the Olympic Games until 50 days after the end of the Paralympic Games, that there would be a time, a real focus on peace and peace building within the UK and also throughout the world. So our Pass It On campaign is trying to support bringing together the Olympic Games, the sports and peace and solidarity. And it's been running now. We started it back in, I think it was October last year, but it's running right throughout the period of the Games, the Paralympic Games, and it'll be carrying on for those 50 days until the 50 days after the end of the Olympic Games, as we'll have that as a real focus. We wanted to encourage people to take part.
Can I ask you, what are some of the most memorable or inspirational messages that have been posted online?
Well, some of the recent ones, for example, Martha has said, "Peace does not just mean the absence of war and conflict, but a bond of friendship and love that causes people and countries to never want war and conflict." And other people have mentioned, "Peace means seeing us all as equals," or, "Peace to me is a world where everyone gets an equal chance to flourish."
I gather that the focus of peace building in this is you're focusing on five particular countries. Is that right? Can you tell us a bit more about that?
Yes. That's right. We've got stories from five countries where we work on our website. So we've got the stories of people in Uganda, Colombia, Rwanda, the Philippines and the UK in Kenya. And we had Abdi, who came over from Kenya for the Flame Congress in March. And we've had John McBride, who was one of the Olympic torchbearers. He's gone back over to Kurocho and he has physically passed on the Olympic torch to the people in St. John's Sports Society. So that's one of the stories that you can find out about on our website. We also have, like I say, we've mentioned the story in the UK. So the Mizzen family, Margaret and Barry Mizzen's son Jimmy, was killed in 2008. And they have been working for peace within the UK. They were involved when the Pope came to visit Hyde Park. They were speaking at Hyde Park. And through that, they found out about the work of CAFOD and the work that we do, supporting peace around the world. And they've actually been to visit some other mothers who've lost children through violence. I think they visited Rwanda and were able to share stories. So there's a lot of sharing and solidarity in this peace campaign.
And talking of sharing and solidarity, you mentioned one of the Olympic torchbearers, John McBride. I gather he's also a CAFOD fundraiser, and he ran part of his leg of the relay in bare feet as a sign of solidarity with poor people around the world. Isn't that right?
He did. He's been a real inspiration. A few years ago, he visited Kenya and visited Korogocho. And there he saw that there were lots of young people who were running in bare feet. And when he came back, he decided to do fundraising. He's done a lot of marathons and long races. And what he does is, for the last mile of every race that he does, he takes off his shoes and he runs the last mile barefoot. So he's become known as the barefoot runner. And so he, for the work that he has done for CAFOD, was nominated and was chosen to be an Olympic torchbearer. So he did. He mentioned sort of when he went down to take off his shoes, I think there was some consternation. But he said, "No, this is what I'm going to do in solidarity with the people that I've met in Kenya and Korogocho." And he ran that in his bare feet. And then he, as I said, he then took the torch back to Kenya to Korogocho, and they had a run, they had a relay in Korogocho with lots of young people from St John's Sports Society and John, so they were all running and they were passing the torch from one to another, and then he's left his torch, he's passed it on to the people of Korogocho, and I think that's the sort of person that he is. He's a very inspirational person.
I was talking to Susan Kambula, a coordinator of CAFOD's Olympic Peace Campaign. There was good news coming out of the recent International AIDS Conference in Washington. The HIV virus can be kept in check nowadays with a range of better medication, and more people are now receiving the life-saving antiretroviral drugs. But as always, there's the other side of the coin. Adequate funding for research into the disease and to treat and care for the sufferers remains a major issue in these financially strapped times. And for every person who receives the antiretroviral drugs, there's another person who doesn't have access to them. Another daunting statistic is that 2.5 million people are still being infected with the AIDS virus every year. So there's no room for complacency. Monsignor Bob Vitillo is the special advisor on AIDS for Caritas Internationalis and was among the participants at the Washington AIDS Conference. I spoke to him just after the conference ended and asked whether he was happy with its outcome. Suffering from the scourge
of HIV. I'm happy for a number of reasons. One is that I feel there has been much progress in terms of seeing the effectiveness when we can provide greater access to more and more people, access to the combination antiretroviral treatment that helps people living with HIV to stay healthy longer and to prolong their lives and have a better quality of life.
In your intervention, however, although you said there'd been good progress on fighting the disease and curtailing the spread of the virus, but you said that funding remains a big issue. Is that because the money's drying up because governments around the world are cutting their health budgets, but, you know, because of the global financial crisis?
Well, it's interesting. Many of the governmental representatives and also the representatives of the big funding agencies, such as the Global Fund to Fight AIDS, TB, and Malaria, as well as PEPFAR, say that money is not drying up. At the same time, they said, at least at our Catholic pre-conference, that money will probably remain at the same level right now and that we have to be satisfied with that given the economic crisis. However, in that Catholic pre-conference, the people who are involved in Catholic programs in different parts of the world made the point that we can't do more with less when we still have half of the people who need the antiretroviral medications not having access to them. We must find the ways to provide access to them and also to maintain the people who are on the treatment. They actually predict that by the year 2030, that we'll have 50 million people who need to be on antiretroviral treatment. And so we can't say do more with less or forget about the people who don't have access right now.
And when we talk about the people who don't have access right now, what numbers are we talking of?
Well, actually, half of the people who need the treatment are not on it. The latest reports by UNAIDS indicate that we have 8 million people who now have access to antiretroviral therapy. And that's really wonderful because it means that people are not developing the serious illnesses related to AIDS and they're living longer. But at the same time, we have about 16 million who need that. So it's really only 50% coverage that we have right now.
Do you think there's a risk of complacency setting in when it comes to AIDS, you know, given that the virus has been around for more than 3 decades now? And people nowadays often tend to think, oh, well, you know, you can manage the disease just by taking your antiretroviral drugs.
I think there's a risk of complacency, and there's also a serious risk of false security. In one sense, I understand why they have tried to craft very positive messages at this latest International AIDS Conference, the theme of coming to the end of AIDS. And certainly we've made good scientific progress, and if we could increase the access to the medicines, and if people begin to change their behaviors that put them at risk of infection, maybe someday we will see an AIDS-free generation. At the same time, if we only look at the positives, then we could feel like we've done enough and we need to move on to new challenges in the world, or we could feel like this is over already, so we don't have to worry about AIDS anymore.
Coming to the role of the Catholic Church, which of course is the biggest carer of those living with the virus or with full-blown AIDS in many developing countries or other countries around the world, is that role growing in importance?
I believe that the role definitely has grown in importance over the years. The Catholic Church was there at the beginning of HIV and AIDS. It was one of the first institutions to accept people living with AIDS and to care for them. At that time, we had no treatment, and so the Catholic Church at least tried to comfort them, help their families, and help the patients die with dignity. Since that time, we've changed the roles. We continue to provide compassion to those who are seriously ill, but we also have reached out with antiretroviral treatment as resources have become available to the Catholic Church. And so excellent treatment programs have been developed. In fact, in South Africa alone, the Catholic Church is the second greatest provider of antiretroviral treatment in the country, second only to the government program. So we've done a great deal, and we continue to do a great deal. And at the same time, we continue to promote our ages-long teaching of responsible behavior so that we help people to avoid the risk of becoming infected in the first place.
But is that message getting through? Is there the behavior change that is needed to try to curb the spread of this disease?
There has been some positive tendencies to behavior change. And in fact, in those countries where the infection rate has decreased significantly, countries like Uganda, Kenya, Thailand, it's indicated that people have changed their behavior. They're reducing the number of sexual partners they have. They're waiting longer for sexual debut. And this is much closer to the message of the Catholic Church, which, of course, promotes abstinence outside of marriage and mutual and permanent fidelity within marriage. So there has been behavior change, but it's not enough. And I think that the church must continue its teaching and help people to develop responsible behavior.
Okay, finally, to look to the future, how optimistic are you that you will see the development of an effective vaccine to treat AIDS in your lifetime?
Well, I don't know. I can't predict how long I'll live, so I'm not sure of that. But I think at this conference, we did have at least some positive news. There's been a vaccine that's been in trials in Thailand, and it showed, at least with the group that were being studied, it showed about 31% effectiveness. This is the most positive news that we've had on vaccine development. Probably it will still take a number of years, at least, to find an effective vaccine, and especially one that's going to be applicable to the many different strains of the virus, and also that's going to be cost-effective to produce so that it'll be available to the people who need it most in poor and isolated countries. But I think this is a step forward, and we need to be hopeful that we'll come to the day when we have an effective vaccine that can cover all people.
I was speaking to Monsignor Bob Vitillo, Special Advisor on AIDS for Caritas Internationalis. Well, that's all for today from me, Susie Hodges, here at Vatican Radio's English programme. But we'll be on the air again at the same time tomorrow. And don't forget, you can always find our programmes on the internet at www.vaticanradio.org. Laudato Jesus Christus.